get there with MINT. Get there with MINT.
Hi there. Thanks for listening to MIMT's podcast. My name's Graeme DeGoldie, and I'm rapt to be talking today to a name that many therapists would have heard of on their journey, and that's Michael Stanborough. Today I'd like to talk to Michael about his time at the Rolfing Institute. You know, what took him there, and how did an interest in fascia begin? And what drove Michael to choose fascia as an area of expertise? What drove his career path, and how does he perceive the new research pertaining to fascia? An educator, a photographer, and a very kind man, let's chat with one of the forefathers of myofascial education, Michael Stanborough. Welcome.
It's really great to be here.
You found your way here, obviously, and we've been in friendship for well over, I'm going to go back and say about 30 years.
I think that's right.
Yeah. I can vividly remember, and I was talking to Rob Granter about this not all that long ago. Mm. Rob and I did a course with you, I'm going to say 1990 or 1991 in Box Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And you were a lot, well, we were all a lot younger then, but you were teaching myofascial release back then.
Mm.
So you've been in the industry a long time.
I have, yeah. I really, it's about 40 years. I'm shocked to say. So I think back then I was still living in the United States and coming back to visit my family, who I'm from Blackburn, which, as you know, is just a suburb over from Box Hill. And somehow or other that led to me contacting Ralph Haddon, who owned the school there at the time. Yeah. And that's how we met, through one of the classes. I think the first class I taught with, or for Ralph at MSTT, it was you and Rob and a number of other people who've actually stayed in the industry all these years.
Yeah, yeah. Look, there was a few of us at that one, Gary Maritas. There was these names that spring up that are still in the industry, which is, wow.
Yeah, yeah.
that long. Well, look, it's great to have you here, and I'm really sort of keen to get sort of like the background story of how you got to where you are, because you're a bit of a legend.
Oh, ha
ha. But look, where did you grow up? What schools did you go to? Because you got a bit of an American twang there.
That's
and
right.
People are interested in that.
Yeah. So I started life without an American twang and grew up in Blackburn.
Mm.
And I went to Laburnum Primary School, the local primary school, and then to Box Hill High, which at that time was Box Hill Boys High. Not too many good things to say about it, I regret to say, except for some really great friends that I made there, some of whom I've just reconnected with recently. So it's been really quite great to be in touch with some of my old friends from that time. And then I went off to Monash University after I finished high school, but I didn't finish university at that time, and I moved up to Sydney and got quite involved in cooking, of all things. And
so what were you studying at – what did you enroll in at uni?
I did the first year of an arts degree.
So okay.
The first person in my family to go to university. My dad was a public servant. He and my mom were both Depression children, raised in the Depression. My dad particularly came from, you know, a pretty hard life during the Depression. So For him, you know, the public service was like, aha, you know, it was security and it was really an achievement for him, I think, to have that kind of, job security and feel like he could raise a family, which I think, you know, he and my mom did very successfully.
Yes.
And so there was no sort of background for me in terms of, you know, certainly massage or even cooking for that matter. So Monash was arts. I felt kind of like a lot of people who go off to university after high school and not exactly sure even why I'm here. But, you know, I didn't want to let the team down because, as I said, I was the first one to go to wow. university. But
yeah.
it wasn't a fit at that time. And so I finished university later on in the United States. And so I went off to Sydney and I pursued this interest in chefing. And I worked in a couple of very sort of high-end restaurants in Sydney.
Really?
Barara Waters Inn, which some people may have heard of with the legendary recently deceased, I saw Tony Bilson.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to do an apprenticeship as a chef.
Really?
Yeah. And then just impulsive 23-year-old, I said, not going to do that. I'm going to go to the United States and go to massage school.
What? But why? But why?
Why? There was a guy, a friend, who I surfed with up in Sydney. And he was an osteopath.
Yeah.
And he taught at the Osteopathic College in Sydney, which at the time was... if you can believe this, it was a 2-year program.
And, wow.
And at the end of it, you were qualified, certified as a osteopath and a chiropractor.
Yes.
And when I look back, I think, why didn't I do that? That was his encouragement. He said, but I also had the kind of gypsy gene, I think, somewhere, and I wanted to combine some sort of adventure with massage school, and I thought that would probably what I would do is go to massage school in Boulder, which was had a kind of international reputation for being a kind of school, a significant school. Like, this is in 1979, they had like a 1200-hour program. It was pretty full-time, well-structured course, and I had friends who'd lived in Boulder and said, oh, it's just one of the great places. And
yeah, so just to get to that point,
yeah.
did you?
Yeah.
It was only because you spoke to a mate you decided to do massage. Is that right? Or did you have a little bit of an interest in it?
It sounds a bit random when you put it like that. Like, I was I was being treated by my friend David.
Yeah.
And I liked the work that he did.
Yes.
So in terms of personal experience, you know, not so much just the concept of osteopathy, but the feeling of it in my own body, it was quite made a strong impression, I think, is a good way of saying it.
Was that because of a pre-existing injury, or was it because you got a wipe out on a 10-foot wave? And
a little bit of, wiping out on some, some waves. There's a bit of damage from surfing. I think more, combination of things. Like, I'd had for really a long part of my sort of later adolescent adult life this kind of very restricted area in my mid-thoracic area. I didn't know how to talk like that back then. It was just like the middle of my back hurts.
Mid-back pain.
Fix it. And he was someone who did help with that. And I was like, oh, well, that's good. And And I was starting, you know, so this is kind of intersecting now with the sense that the problem with chefing is that it's a crazy stressful job.
I could imagine.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's hot in a commercial kitchen, a lot of pressure, timing has to be just right. A lot of chefs are extremely bad-tempered people because they're just so stressed out, and a lot of them are, you know, alcoholics or close to it. And so I started to analyze the culture of cooking, and I like the camaraderie of working in a commercial kitchen when it's really just happening. Yeah. It's got quite a buzz about it.
Mm-hmm.
But also I was starting to think, I just not seeing that as something I want to do. And so I put together this combination of sort of, you know, when I went to Boulder, even I was aware that it was in the middle of America in the Rocky Mountains, but this was how much I had my sense of adventure. I took my surfboard with me because I thought, I'll only be here a year. I'll do massage school and then I'll move on to somewhere in Barbados or somewhere in the West Indies.
Move down to Mexico.
Move down somewhere in the Central America and continue surfing. Well, that
great
never
surf
happened.
Down there. Yeah.
So, initially it was like I go to Boulder, do massage school. And then kind of move on, but
Just out of curiosity, what size board did you have back then?
Oh, it was short.
A short board.
Oh, yeah, it was short. Like it was a twin fin. I remember Mark Richards was
sensational,
inspiring the world with his twinnies. Like I maybe it was like. Yeah. What, 6 footer? 5'10"?
5'10".
Yeah. When I look now, like, you know, if I went out now, I'd be looking for 8'10". Yeah, I mean, it was very exhausting to paddle around on that board.
Oh, God. I can see you with this bloody thing under tow in the middle of nowhere.
Well, never got to the middle of nowhere. I don't know where it is now, probably in the bottom of landfill somewhere.
God. You've got a real passion for photography,
I do.
To move aside from that. But you have a passion for photography.
Yeah.
You've got your own website and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
What drew you to that? And has that been a lifelong passion?
No, not so much. A kind of recent discovery. I bought my first DSLR, which in camera speak means a fairly sort of a high spec camera. At the time it was not like the top of the line anything, but it was a decent camera, and I bought that just for taking photos in the classes I was teaching,
yes,
for before and after things. And there was a particular software program that we had where you could create these really quite incredible kind of before and after, sort of tile things up and get these quite useful image sets that would help you track someone's process through Rolfing structural integration. And then I just thought, oh, I've got this nice camera, and I would like to see, you know, about and I've always liked landscape photography when it's, you know, I've admired it when I've seen it. It's like, oh, really gorgeous, and I feel like it gives you some sense of kind of lifts your spirit somehow,
yes,
a bit like if you're there,
yeah,
being in that setting. So I thought I'll have a shot at that. So I went out with my kit lens and my kit camera and started to shoot some things, and just a learning curve. And here and there I was like, oh, I like that. And then you get into Photoshop, and then you get into Lightroom, the things that really help you make your images
better.
Pop, really. And, you know, so when you're shooting what's called a RAW file, which might be Greek to a lot of people, but in photography now there's this file format that's kind of like you have all this unlimited potential really in the file format, and it's what you do in your computer with that.
Yeah.
It's like a negative really from film cameras.
Yes.
And so, yeah, and So it's a nice match for me with my kind of nerdy, techie side, kind of geeky sort of thing with a sense, I hope, of creativity as well.
Yeah, I've looked at it. Some of them are absolutely sensational.
Yeah, thank you.
We, as a school, we have quite a few photographers in the teaching realm. And
the administrative side of things.
Absolutely. Andrew Garner's photography. We've got Rob. Rob Grandin does a fair bit of photography. Yeah. And quite a few of the staff are into that.
Yeah.
I don't know what the connection is, but everyone seems to love it.
Some interest in pixel capture and manipulation, and there's something magical about going out into a setting that is just gorgeous, gorgeous situation, and then to come back with an image that somehow or other actually captures the feeling of it. It's really... it's a very nice feeling. Yeah.
Look, and I just thought Dr. Carl Ridgway was another photographer and artist. I wonder if there's a connection between body work and artistic creation or creativity. Amazing. Just a side bit.
Yeah.
So you're married?
Yes.
Couple of children?
Yes.
Your wife, Victoria, is a...
Well, principally a singer and probably then, almost equal parts singer, singing teacher. So she has quite an active studio teaching singing and then, has different situations where she sings professionally and currently trying to launch, which seems like it's going to happen, even though COVID has definitely delayed a band called Revamp, which is if anybody out there listening knows of Postmodern Jukebox, it's that kind of mashup of old songs with kind of groovy new sound to it. It's very nice. And so it's seven-piece
band.
Yeah. So Victoria's singing and two backup singers. And, it's got a really great great sound. And so fantastic. October they have an actual gig.
Oh, great.
It's been a long time coming. There's been a lot of disappointment for musicians.
It's
been really, really very tough. Very tough. Mm. Yeah.
As it has been for massage therapists, myotherapists, and anyone else in the body work area.
It's been a tough couple of years.
Two boys?
A girl boy.
A girl boy?
Yeah.
And how old?
33 this year for Farah, the girl, and 24 for son.
Oh.
Is that right? No, 34 and 24.
Get that right.
Yeah,
I
got to get that right.
Oh, geez. Over the COVID period, when it was fairly stressful time for a lot of people, we had to do a fantastic sort of meditation program for us and for our trainers. And you have a real interest in Buddhism, and how much of an interest in Buddhism
is there?
A monk?
Was I ever a monk?
Yeah.
No, I've never been attracted to that particularly. And one of the things that I enjoyed discovering within the particular area of Buddhism where I've particularly found myself attracted to and practiced and studied in within Tibetan Buddhism, although some of the schools in Tibetan Buddhism, becoming a monk is featured and encouraged in other schools, you could say that the path of a non-Buddhist is also considered you know, important and valid. And so that's where I found myself. I was at times drawn to some of the very long retreats that you can do. In the end, I felt like that would be, in some ways, a sort of selfish thing because, you know, it's there, see you later for 3 years. And, so I've done, you know, some quite long retreats, 3 months and a number of month-long things and some solitary retreats and quite a lot of study. Buddhism, I think, is perhaps, you know, Buddhism in general doesn't represent itself quite accurately in the world because I think it's, even though it's listed as one of the four great religions of the world, you know, a lot of particularly Tibetan Buddhist teachers would say it's not especially a religion, you know, it's certainly atheistic. There's no Buddhist god.
No.
But also I think it's more a science of mind and a philosophy of humanity than it is a religion, if we think of religion as something to do with a God and some sense of coming to know God and serving God. Buddhism does not have that. So I think that's what attracted me to it. I suppose sort of philosophically, I looked at Christianity when I was, I went to Sunday school. I think a lot of us were made to go to Sunday school. I couldn't wait for it to be over so the weekend could resume being fun.
Yeah.
But when I was about 15, I had some interest in just Christianity and I started going to church, but it didn't kind of get me.
Yeah, it didn't connect.
Yeah. So suppose philosophically, I suppose Buddhism's attractive because, you know, not trying to be too fancy, but I think a lot of people of my generation, there's a kind of lot more tendency towards sort of existentialism or, you know, you're just responsible for yourself.
Yes.
Yeah. And Buddhism really has that in the foreground. Yeah, and so yeah, it's been a big part of my life. Yeah.
You've been to Tibet?
No, I never have. No,
Nepal.
I've been to Nepal and loved. I did the trek that I did there with my son. We designed it around visiting monasteries and, you know, significant sacred sites, as they call them, where, you know, and just outside of Kathmandu, there's a cave that's where a famous, I guess now you'd call him maybe a Buddhist saint, Padmasambhava, but an actual historical figure, where he did a very long solitary retreat in this cave. So that's a pilgrimage site for a lot of people. And that's like a 30, 40-minute bus ride outside of Kathmandu. But all through that sort of Khumbu Valley area, there's quite a lot of significant Buddhist sites, monasteries, and the Sherpas are Buddhist. Nepalese, it's a mix of Hindu and Buddhist. And other things as well. It's a wonderful melting pot, Kathmandu. It's amazing. Yeah, it's like, and everybody seems to get along. It's pretty terrific, you know. It seems uncommon in this world that everyone can cohabit and appreciate and respect what other people are into.
Were you a hippie?
I was a hippie. Yeah, I think, and that's where the Buddhist thing came. Probably a little bit back in the hippie days, kind of a surfer hippie. I had a combi. I wish I still had it. It'd be worth about $100,000. Yeah. I had a combi. I tootled up and down the East Coast a couple of times. I think maybe I'm romanticizing this, but I think I was in Noosa when the main street was still a dirt road.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. So, yeah, brilliant. Noosa was not what we think of today. Noosa was just a little town on the coast with an amazing break or breaks. Yeah.
Fantastic. Mm. We're going to just take a short break and we're going to come back to Michael and we're going to focus more on his career as a therapist and see if we can get some golden nuggets of advice. So we're just going to take a short break and we'll be right back with you.
Get there with MIMT.
Thanks. Welcome back. Michael, what drew you to fascia prior to going to the Rolfing Institute? I mean, and why did you choose that?
Yeah.
With all these courses, you chose to go sort of to the top straight away.
Yeah.
Jeez, that sounded enthusiastic.
Yeah. Well, I think, the order came a little bit more around Rolfing and then trying to burrow down into fascia. So the order's a little different. It wasn't like, fascia, who's engaged with that, who's talking about that, that's the Rolf Institute. Again, it was a bit like the osteopath. I knew the Rolf Institute was in Boulder, and I knew a little bit about the kind of general principles, but I went along and got a treatment, and I was really impressed, and really, with all respect to my friend David back in Sydney, much more impressed with the depth of the effect. And so that got me interested in Rolfing, and then I started reading as much as there was around Rolfing, and of course fascia was right there in the foreground. And Ida Rolf, who interestingly had a lot of the influences on the development of her work, do come from osteopathy.
Mm.
And, so the osteopaths were talking about fascia before she was. It wasn't like she just sort of pulled this rabbit out of the hat and said, hey, we haven't been paying attention to this. Even Andrew Taylor Still, the founder of osteopathy, had talked about it in 1889 or something like that. And one of her, Ida Rolf's close friends, a lifetime friend, was an osteopath. So she, in some ways, was bringing fascia in from the influences over in that sort of osteopathic side. And I think what she put in was this sense of the significance or the importance of balancing the body in the field of gravity. And she felt that manipulating the fascia was the kind of key to achieving that goal. And so, I suppose all Rolfers of the time, we inherited a kind of version of what was happening under our hands and what made it possible to get these, at times, quite dramatic changes. And so... that included, really, when I look back on it, sort of hypothetical models about what was happening with fascia. Ida Rolf was a PhD biochemist.
Yes.
And so she had some, I suppose, authority or to make well-informed conjecture. But she herself said, well, I think time will tell us what's actually happening.
Yes.
But I'm proposing these ideas. And, you know, some of them have turned out to be kind of verifiable with this significant amount of research that's occurring these days. I don't know that she ever actually talked about fascia. She was fascia as being a kind of stretchable material. She said, I think that we'll find that most of the changes are happening more in the ground substance, in the fluid. But there was still discussion around, you know, tearing cross-linkages from collagen fibers.
Yeah,
you know,
that's the big thing at the minute, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Hydrogen bonds and covalent bonds. We all learned to talk the talk of molecular bonding, and that we felt very strongly that you know, fascial work of the kind we were doing could release those.
Yeah, I see in an article, when Ida Rolf began putting her hands and elbows on people's skin and applying pressure, creating a slow, sustained stretch, she imagined that she was stretching fascial sheets. And that was the way she described it at that particular time. So you say at that particular time, that was how she best imagined it to be working to the best of her ability. But then we've had research come from there, sort of like everything, and Robert Shelp, who's one of the organisers of the first fascial research congress. He was credited with discovering minute contractile fibres in fascia. And it started to unwind this theory of stretching fascia, and one study found that collagen fibers would only begin to stretch shortly before they reached breaking point.
Right, that's right. So basically you had to tear it apart to make it change in that model. That's right, yeah.
So in some of the forums and groups that I get involved with and read with, the people are saying that, well, you can achieve the same result just doing hands-on massage. Would that be anywhere near correct or...?
I think so. Here's a kind of diplomatic answer, but I also think I think that there's a number of ways to engage with, you know, the soft tissue, if you like, that will address the potential that's within fascia to change. I think that one element, or maybe there's two elements that really make the kind of style of work that I inherited from Ida Rolf, which we can call direct release technique.
Yes.
Is one, there's a lot of tension put in the fascia that's not possible to achieve if there's a lot of oil involved.
Yes.
So I love massage, and that was my background. I went to massage school and I learned really amazing massage when I was there, and I still like to receive that. But to me, the outcomes, I feel like massage is much more talking in that way, in a kind of general massage sense, is much more talking to interoceptors, slow twitch fibers that are mediated at the insular cortex. So it's the kind of the profound power of touch.
You know, absolutely.
It nurtures your brain. It nurtures your whole being, really. Yay, you know, who wouldn't want that? I think where the kind of Rolfing approach and where I would say then I can't say that there are any longer operating in parallel. I think that by putting these tensions and pressure and the time that you leave them there, it enables the, as I presented at the School Soft Tissue Forum a couple of years ago, it enables this process of mechanoreception to take place, and so that the forces that the therapist are applying are being responded to, and there's a lot of research support for this. So this isn't just kind of, you know, fluff, that it's really affecting the gene expression within the fibroblasts, and there's, and so that it has to be something. For it to be meaningful, it has to be of some certain duration. And just massage, say, an effleurage stroke where you're just moving across something and then moving across it again without developing a lot of sustained tension in the tissue, while I would say it would also be probably producing some change in gene expression. I haven't read anything about that.
No.
But it seems highly likely.
Mm.
But we do know that fascial work is doing that.
And, yes.
To double back or sort of get back on track with your initial question, yeah. Graham, I think that, like any time you're doing massage of any kind, you're obviously engaging with the fascia. It's everywhere.
Yes.
Wrapped, as we know. It's everywhere. But whether the treatment approach is affecting the fascial physiology, I would say not all massage does that.
No.
Yeah.
No.
And yeah, and I think the deep changes in autonomic nervous system function that have been studied and measured through Rolf method soft tissue work, as it was called in the research study, demonstrates that there's quite heightened effects and changes in the autonomic nervous system that occur with their style of work. And again, I think that some of those changes probably occur, and it's hard to say what is massage anymore, but say oil, conventional kind of oil massage in a kind of, say, Swedish style, it probably has some effect on autonomic function, but I don't believe from personal experience and observation that it's anywhere near as deep.
Yeah, one of the things that our students often comment on when they go to wet labs is just the fact that a lot of people just think of muscle fiber. They don't realize the extent of fascia on a bigger scale, and I think it's one of the eye-openers for them as they move through their career as a therapist.
Yeah, it's we just know so much more than.
Absolutely.
I remember the first time I went to a wet lab, it was, and actually saw fascia in this way, it was like, wow.
Yeah,
it's a whole lot different than just thinking about it and the kind of abstract notion that you're engaging with it. But then to actually see it, yeah, it's pretty enlightening, really.
So what threw you from, like, just doing the massage therapy?
Yeah.
And doing it's like you've just absolutely been enthralled by it.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah,
And it's been your lifeblood for all these years.
Mm.
It was that, I'm assuming, the influence of Ida Rolf, mm-hmm. or was dramatic?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, dramatic. And there are a number of different points where there was this kind of reinforcement of, like, my, you know, so there's some kind of marriage going on in my life at this point when I'm in Boulder, where I met a very significant Buddhist teacher who did many of the things that he sort of prescribed or recommended in terms of, you know, practices and retreats and so on. And so there was some sense also that Rolfing somehow contributed to the potential of, I don't know, human potential in a way that I had found that I absolutely loved massage school, and part of that was for the sense of community. That
yes.
was so wonderful. Mm, yeah. And yeah. a lot of people say that.
Absolutely.
They miss it when it's over. I know I did. It's like, I think we
all know exactly where you're coming from there.
Yeah, like this group of fellow travelers and, you know, just a lot, you know, from a year of, you know, really shared journey and so on. But, well, no, but for me, the sense of the Rolfing work as kind of going somewhere that's, I don't know, somehow sort of aligned with where I felt like Buddhist practice and study went with, that was kind of very much happening for me at that time. And then the sense of importance for the work at different times, that was kind of like aha. And I think a big aha point was when I started working with children, particularly kids with cerebral palsy.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. And I was working with some American, they don't call physios there, they're physical therapists, PTs.
Yeah.
And I was just working on a couple of them in my practice. They're coming to me for work. And it turned out they were both pediatric physical therapists. And they said, oh, this is really interesting, you know, obvious sort of change happening. Would you do this work on some of the kids that we treat? And with some trepidation, really, even though I know Ida Rolf did a lot of work with children, a lot of work with CP, I was like, okay, I'll give it a go. And in some instances, it's not so much a bragging thing. It was like even I was kind of gobsmacked by the change. You know, like,
and what sort of change were you introducing there?
Yeah,
was it as a result of the spasticity in the muscle,
right, yeah.
and all that?
So I hope we've got time for this. I'll try to keep it narrow it down. Andrew can edit it out. So here's the thing, Graham.
Yes.
So spasticity and I was still operating, you know, with the fascia gel sole model. You could soften the fascia and the muscle behavior would come along for the ride. And so I was working with these kids and I was seeing these big changes in the contracture and that sort of, you know, spastic, what was called, now we call it hypertonic, but that sort of spastic behavior. And observable as it's happening, and even the therapist who would bring the kids to the session were like, wow, you know, that's pretty cool. And one of them even brought along, I think it's called a goniometer
goniometer.
And she would measure these kids as I worked or before and after, and she's like, it's kind of crazy, the changes. And I like to say that every kid I hit a home run like that, and that's not true. But enough of the time, the changes were significant that I got asked, would you teach us how to do it? And they were the first classes ever teaching a group of pediatric therapists in Corpus Christi, Texas, at Ada Wilson Memorial Hospital for Children, how to do myofascial release on mostly CP kids, other conditions. And then that developed into quite a thing for a number of years, a thing meaning I was invited to teach at different places around the United States. And one night over dinner in New York with these quite, you know, very experienced pediatric therapists who'd spent really their whole professional life working with CP kids, I was sort of trotting out my fascial model, and they said very politely, do you think it's actually something to do more with kind of alpha, gamma nervous system stuff? And I just didn't know what they were talking about, actually. so I said, nah. And felt a little threatened, as you do when your paradigm's being challenged, but not in a really, no aggression at all, just friendly kind of, you know, dinner conversation. And so they were just talking about, you know, this sort of alpha-gamma co-activation and how in, you know, spastic or hypertonic muscles you have gamma bias turns into gamma gain. And I was already like, not, you know, speaking Greek to me, but I went away and I looked at it and read a lot more about it and got my head around it, which really, I'd have to say, took a couple of years to really figure out, you know, the gamma motor loop. But I think that that's what, I think that was a big aha moment in terms of dramatic, like, wow, this work, because it's, I think now a lot of the changes we see in hypertonicity are to do with alpha gamma, not so much in the fascia. The fascia stuff is definitely going on, but I think those very rapid changes, like I was seeing with those initial CP patients where and the woman had the goniometer there, to me that's just nervous system stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not so much fascia.
Yeah. So all of this, when you were teaching in the universities and hospitals, that led you on to a career in education. Yeah. And so from your American experience, you decided to come back to Australia, back to Blackburn.
Yeah, initially bought a house in Blackburn right across the street from where I grew up. The big rubber band snapped me back into Blackburn.
So you've come back and you've got into education through a previous school that has since closed down, the Melbourne School of Tactile Therapies.
Yeah.
You have your own education group now, and you've lectured it significantly around the world.
Yeah, I've been really fortunate. I've had invitations to Singapore a few times, South Korea, New Zealand a couple of times, Ethiopia, a really wonderful new school of physiotherapy in Gondar at the University of Gondar Medical School.
You've been I know that you've done a fair bit with presentations for associations and the like, and there's Soft Tissue Therapy Congress, of course. So has any of, you know, oh, you were just talking then, but obviously you're thinking from where you started all those years ago to where, you know, we are now with the research and all that.
Yeah.
Has that model or that expansion of research and thinking sort of changed your treatment protocol per se?
Yes, to some extent, not like a radical overhaul. I think duration of contact, I probably emphasize it being longer and giving the patient, the client, giving their nervous system, their fascia, their fibroblasts, their different, you know, hormones of happiness,
yeah.
You know, molecules of happiness, giving that whole soup a chance to really kind of take the stimulation and turn it into change. And so, yeah, so I think that the initial way that we learned Rolfing was, you know, Rolfing had a reputation for being pretty fierce. And part of that was, you know, well, the fascia is tough and we're going to overpower it and we're going to get it to stretch and we're going to get it to reshape the sheets of fascia, as you were saying. So you got to kind of get stuck into it a bit. And then I think in the feeling at the moment when I'm working is that a lot of the responses are coming they're kind of organic, that arise in the person when the right circumstances arise. Nice.
Yeah.
That doesn't sound too twee, certainly not meant to, because I think, like, wholeheartedly that that's what's happening. Like, I'm providing a stimulation, sometimes quite strong, at other times moderate, sometimes quite soft, but it's all designed to sort of maximize the innate response of the body to that stimulation. So, and like I said, I think that's happening with fascial physiology, and I think it's also happening with the neurologically. Yeah. So we're not so much rolling up our sleeves and kind of getting our elbows sharpened on the grindstone in the morning as we might have done in 1979, 1980. That's it. Yeah.
Let's inflict a bit. Yeah. You look, as I said, there's a lot of therapists that got into myofascial release through your training.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And you certainly influenced a hell of a lot of people. One of the things that you did do was you brought out a book called Direct Release Myofascial Technique, a second edition?
Yeah. So that's it's being considered right now at Churchill Livingston. So it's sort of being – I hope it's good that it's being passed around a little bit. But, yeah, so it's there. The my interest is certainly high. And I, from their side, it's all, I'm sure, to do with, you know, do they think there's money to be associated with putting the effort into that?
Look, the first edition was a great book, and you know, there's lots of students and therapists that would have that in their library as well. And we look forward to the second edition. We're very fortunate you're running a postgraduate training course on July 2nd and 3rd, and that'll be introducing students to new protocols and new areas of treatment. So we're really looking forward to that, and that's on our website for anyone that wants to enroll and see what Michael is teaching. But I suppose just to sort of wind things up a little bit, I always ask everyone that does come to our podcast, is there a nugget of advice that you would give any therapist? And that could be in respect to myofascial work or any type of manual therapy, soft tissue therapy. Is there a nugget of advice in your long and experienced career that you would pass on?
My sense is I would encourage people to specialize and have something that really does, you know, personally excite them and really develop that to the maximum in their practice. So it could be, you know, there's any number of things that might be.
Yeah.
And perhaps even a condition. For a long time, my thing was working with CP children, and I worked in pediatric clinics in the US, and I loved it. It's been just more difficult to kind of get that same population here in Australia. But so whether it's dry needling, cupping, specializing in scoliosis, specializing in different things, but I know some people are generalists and they're enthusiastic about everything, and that's good too, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah. I like the idea of people trying to specialize in if not a technique, if it's a regional area or mm-hmm. something like that. I think it's great for the industry.
Yeah.
So where to from here, Michael Stanborough?
I'm trying to combine the teaching with slowing down a little bit the pace of life. I'm going back to Alice Springs to teach in August. I've been there a few times and just love it. So this is going to be a road trip with the camera.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, and so a bit more of that kind of thing. Going back to Cairns in September, and I'll stick up there, and I might rent a van and head up to Cooktown again, sort of with the camera, and so start to combine teaching out of town with that.
Beautiful.
When I can. Keeping going with clinic. I still enjoy doing the work. I probably, if I look at what's coming up, you know, I'd have to say photography is quite a bit in the foreground.
Beautiful.
And planning a trip to Patagonia next year, which
fantastic.
Photography's on the photographer's bucket list. So heading down to southern Chile and braving the wind and getting to those national parks there and
beautiful
with my camera. Yeah.
Yeah, all those drug lords. Don't go too far into the forest, you mightn't come out. But
I don't think there's too many. I don't know particularly, but I don't think they're too much in Patagonia. It's not a very hospitable climate for drug cultivation. Yeah. I don't think they grow any coca leaves down there.
Michael, it's always great to talk with you. You've been considered a fascial specialist for so many years and recognised by so many in the industry. And anyone that enrols into one of Michael's courses or walk away with so many takeaways, so many things to put into immediate practice that it's just a golden opportunity. So once again, thank you, Michael. Thank you, Andrew, our production manager, and thanks everyone for listening. We look forward to hearing and seeing you all soon. Thank you.
MIMT would like to thank our host today, Graham DeGoldy, our guest speaker, Michael Stanborough, and our production manager, Andrew Garner. This podcast has been brought to you by the Melbourne Institute of Massage and Myotherapy. Get there with MIMT.